Welcome to the Seahawkers podcast. I'm Brandon Schultz of the Military Seahawkers, and joining me from the road, my good buddy and Montana Seahawker, Adam Emmert.
Yeah, I am on the road, and I'm kind of hoping that maybe that we'd have a legal expert in the great state of Wyoming / Nebraska, because currently I'm in southeastern Wyoming and about to cross into Nebraska, but I'm not sure if it's illegal to pod and drive, but that's what I'm doing. I'm podding and driving.
You're podding and driving. Okay, well then. I thought you had a co-pilot, too, that was there to help out, so it's I feel like you're in the clear.
Well, yeah, I do have a co-pilot here, and she's incredible. But unfortunately, there's wind gusts up to 60 miles an hour because, for whatever reason, people like built roads and live out in this godforsaken place where the wind blows 60 miles an hour one direction. It's insane.
All right. Well, we are podding, and Adam is driving, and we have a show to get out, and because we have so many wonderful people who listen to the show that we want to check in with every week. And we have a game to talk about, Adam, with the Seahawks getting a 27-20 win over the Atlanta Falcons. And I don't know if people are quite over the fact that the Seahawks got out to a 24-0 lead. You know how I love those fast starts. I call for it every single week. We finally got one, but then they don't put together two halves of football that look exactly the same, and the Falcons able to come back and make a little bit of a game. It got kind of close there toward the end.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't have been surprised at that outcome if it hadn't have been Matt Schaub coming back in the second half.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who hasn't played suddenly can, you know, throw up almost 500 yards worth of passing on our defense, which was super frustrating. But I remember, you know, seeing the halftime score and sitting with my dad and being like, oh, don't worry, we're going to give up at least three consecutive scores here. This is going to get really close and we'll win by less than 10 points. Like, that's what we'll do. Because that's what we do. Because for whatever reason, this team does not believe in playing the same type of defense, no matter the situation on the clock. And I understand there's some situational things that you should take into account, but just going into prevent defense just to like try to milk out the clock at the end of every half or an entire half is no way to win a football game.
Well, and that's why it did get so close in the second half. I think if they tend to stop the deep passes anyway, but I suppose when you do have a guy like Julio Jones lining up on the other side of the football field, you do want to contain him somewhat. And I think that maybe they were coaching a little bit to, not to lose. And I think part of it, too, is the quarterback that you're going up against. There's probably not a lot of confidence that Matt Schaub is going to be the one to bring the team back. But when your defense doesn't get a pass rush on a 38-year-old quarterback, he's a guy who can pick apart a defense because he's experienced. He's, he's had a lot of time in the league and he has good receiving weapons to throw to.
He has good receiving weapons to throw to. And then also when you look at the secondary of the Seahawks, I mean, basically down to, Griffin as a starter and then what? T2, who's, I guess, technically a starter, who's now no longer a starter and on IR. And then, a bunch of backups,
right?
Like that's who he's going up against. That definitely makes it more of a challenge. And that would be the one thing you'd point at and be like, okay, it's not as bad as it looks. I mean, we had all our backups in. I get it. But the thing is they've done this all year. I understand the scheme is to prevent the big play and keep everything underneath, but you got to be more aggressive on the stuff underneath. Like this doesn't work long term.
And I do want to kind of get into this issue that I have with the defense, because one of the things that jumped out at me when looking at the players who are giving up the most yards after the catch, because I think when you're allowing some of that underneath stuff, you have to be quick to the football, right? You see what happens. You got to be quick to the ball, but there's four players on the Seahawks defense who are giving up the most yards after the catch. And I'm kind of curious if you'd be able to pick out who those four players are in the correct order. I don't know if I want to, with you being on the road, maybe I don't try and quiz you quite that way. But I'll
quiz away, buddy. You act like I can't do this. All right.
Okay.
I would say
four players giving up the most yards after the catch and the order on the Seahawks defense.
Oh, and order. Well, okay. My first guess would be KJ Wright.
KJ Wright is number one on the list. Congratulations. 32 completions, 172 yards after the catch.
Okay. Number two would be Kendricks.
Kendricks is number three, and two and three are pretty close. Kendricks, 24 completions, 125 yards.
Okay. So number two must be Wags then.
Yep. 22 completions, 145 yards.
Yeah. All right. So that's three. And then the fourth would be whoever's playing free safety.
It's actually Trey Flowers, who didn't play in this game. 26 completions, 98 yards. He's your number four. So, yeah, the safety, surprisingly, not on the list.
Yeah, well, I guess so. But, you know, and Trey Flowers, like, it's tough to kind of judge his game because first couple of weeks struggled and then has really started to put together the last couple of weeks, even though he didn't play, you know, against Atlanta. But he's really starting to turn the corner and you can kind of see that he's getting sound with his technique. So I worry about him the least. The safeties I don't worry about a ton because the guys that have been playing aren't the guys that will be playing. That I think that's helpful to have Diggs and McDougal starting back there at some point here.
And Blair Blair has actually played pretty well in the time that we've seen him on the field.
Yeah, I'm very comfortable with Blair being out there. I think that's great. He's really looked good as a rookie, and he looks to be a guy who's going to be able to contribute going down the stretch. So if you got those three guys to rotate through, I think you're going to be fine there. But, yeah, the linebackers are getting eaten up a little bit underneath. And I listened to Pete Carroll's press conference, and he basically alluded to the fact that he liked a lot of the things the defense was doing, one being, you know, limiting big plays. And then he said, well, we got to do better against the intermediate stuff, obviously. And he's like, but there's a ton of positive numbers that point to us playing this base defense all the time. And it's like, okay, well, what are those?
What are those positive numbers? I actually have some of those positives, Adam. Some positives with the defense. The Seahawks are top 10 in red zone scoring percentage. They're actually number seven. So I think that's one of the things that you can point to and say, hey, the Seahawks are number seven in the league. And you look at some of those teams being, you know, New England number one, San Francisco number two. You got other teams up there. Dallas is at number five, Pittsburgh at number six. So those are they're limiting their opponents in terms of scoring touchdowns right now.
See, that's a dirty little stat, though, because if you think about it, you know, red zone percentage, great. But the problem is that they're letting them into the red zone every single freaking drive.
Yeah, I could definitely see that being a little bit of a misleading stat. So the other one that I look at is the opponent's third down conversion percentage, which they are also ranked number seven in the league. And actually, they're tied at number six in the league. And this one might be more indicative of your better defenses in the NFL. You got New England number one, Dallas number two, San Fran number three, New Orleans is at number four, and Chicago at number five. So third down conversion percentage, Seahawks among the top 10 in the league there too.
Right. And Pete alluded to that in his press conference as well. And he said, but the problem is we let him do too well on first and second down. Minor detail.
Yeah, they are giving up, I think, a lot of first downs on first and second down, too. So, you can look at the stats in certain ways, but I think Pete Carroll in his press conference is happy with those two stats in particular with the defense.
Yeah, so Pete Carroll will put a positive spin on this because that's what he is. And he'll take these positive stats and he'll look at them and be like, see, it's working. It's working, this three linebacker thing. And I mean, in a sense it is. And I think the real reason why he likes what's going on is that they've been pretty good against the run. And he really wants to stop the run. He doesn't want to give up the deep ball. And they're not doing those two things. And he'll live with everything in the middle. The problem is that they're giving so dang much over the middle and in that intermediate range that these linebackers are getting, quote-unquote, burned. And it's looking bad on their stats with the yards given up after the catch. But a lot of it is those receivers are just running behind them. And then they've got to try to chase them down and make the tackle. And this isn't a sustainable way for us to win in the playoffs. I mean, it's not gonna work. And if this defense isn't gonna get better, this is gonna be a first round exit in the playoffs for the Seahawks. There's no doubt about it.
Well, and I can see from the perspective of when it comes to the playoffs, but of course the goal is getting to the playoffs first. And it's kind of interesting to hear you talk about that idea of Pete Carroll being okay with everything in between, because you and I, Adam, have had the mantra on the show of what now when it comes to yards.
Yeah, well, it doesn't matter. And I am a believer in that, obviously. But it's one thing if you can one every other drive or every three drives actually stop them in the midfield and get the ball back and not be pinned back at the like five and you know, actually have a couple stops. But we're not getting those. Every time it's let them all the way down to, you know, the 10-yard line and then hope that they only kick field goals.
Yeah.
Like that's what we're doing, and which is fine. I mean, I don't want to become terrible in the red zone and worry too much about the middle of the field. But I also can see right now that they're giving up way too many points.
Well, points do matter. That is one thing that, you know, it's kind of has been the epitome, this 2019 season. It's kind of been the epitome of yards don't matter because it comes up so many times, and it's come up so often, in fact, Adam, that we now have a jingle for it.
Oh, no way. Okay.
Yards don't matter.
Yeah, it's a little like the more you know, you know.
Right. Yeah, that's Ron Evans from the How Bizarre podcast. And thanks to Christopher Hart for helping get that for us. I think this is going to come in handy for many shows down the road this season.
Yards don't matter.
I love it. It really does, you know, kind of fit nicely with the theme of the show for the year, it seems like. But I mean, they do and they don't matter. They mainly don't matter, but you gotta at least be able to stop them a few times in the middle of the field.
Yeah.
Between the 20s. You have to. You can't just give up, you know, a field goal every drive and then hope that Russ is going to go down there and score a touchdown on every drive, because the offense isn't quite consistent enough to do that. But the offense overall playing pretty well.
Well, and the other thing that you didn't bring up was turnovers, and the Seahawks are top five in the league when it comes to getting the turnovers on the defensive side of the ball. So that's another thing that I think Pete Carroll looks at that and says, okay, we're successful there. But yeah, it's awfully hard to look at the Falcons' drives from this past week, and you see the only punt in the entire game from the Falcons was on the very first drive that Atlanta had their possession. Other than that, they missed a field goal, had an interception, and it was actually a pretty nice little interception from Michael Kendricks.
Schaub from the shotgun, play fake, looks, going to throw one down the seam. It's intercepted, Kendricks. Matt Schaub was throwing down the seam, trying to get to Julio Jones, and leaping to make the interception was Michael Kendricks. And the Seahawks take over in Atlanta territory.
So you had that interception. Then you had another missed field goal by Matt Bryant. And those were some pretty long field goals. He ends up losing his job over those two misses. And then they fumble to end the first half. So five first half drives. And two, they have an attempt at points and they miss out. And the other two end in turnovers.
Yeah, and you talk about the turnovers, and we've talked about kind of the defensive philosophy here. And these are all the stats and the philosophy that Pete Carroll cared about when the LOB was fully at the peak of their powers. And it worked. It worked really well then. So what's the difference? And the difference to me is during the time that the opposing offense is between the 20s and marching down the field, the theory has been that you don't give up any big plays. You make them execute on a bunch of different plays going down the field. You're trying to make them, you know, have a long drive that they have to be clean and execute well on 10 to 13 plays going down the field before they get to the red zone. And odds are they're going to make a mistake somewhere in there. Yeah. And you'll get them to punt and you'll be fine. The problem is that even though this version of the defense is doing well in the red zone, doing pretty well on third downs, doing well in the turnover categories, all the things that were hallmarks to the LOB, they're not the same as the LOB in the way that they are making it unbelievably difficult play in and play out to make that drive all the way down the field. It's just too easy. Instead of being like 3 to 4 yard completions and then the receivers are getting thumped, the guys are relatively open and then run for 15 yards down the field. And so it takes three plays to get down the field.
Well, when you do look at the drive chart against the Falcons, though, it does play out kind of how you mentioned it. Even on the field goals, it took them nine plays to get into field goal range. It took them seven plays on the second field goal. And on the scoring drives, in the second half, it was a seven-play drive, a 10-play drive, an eight-play drive that led to the Marquise Blair fumble, and an 11-play drive that led to the Falcons' touchdown, and then another eight-play drive at the end. So in terms of the amount of time that was coming off the clock and making them run a lot of plays, it does kind of fit of what Pete Carroll's kind of looking for. He's probably wanting a few more plays in there, though. It does feel like they're giving up too many big plays in terms of what I remember from that Falcons game.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, I guess it's so hard to put a finger on, like, exactly where and why this defense sucks right now.
It's the pass rush, Adam. It's the pat there. Matt Schaub is a 38-year-old man who doesn't want to get hit, and he had no problem standing back there comfortably for nearly the entire game. The couple times where he did get pressure, he fumbled the football with Jadeveon Clowney. Bobby Wagner came rushing at him up the middle, and he just fell down to the ground because he didn't want to get hit. He had all day and just did not have to worry about getting hit by the defensive line.
So where do you see that getting better this season? Yeah, I don't know that I do.
I don't know that I do either.
Only in the sense is early on in the season, we were like, okay, we got Clowney. That's cool. Once Ziggy's back, like that'll, you know, they'll pair up and they'll be a dynamic duo. And then when Jared Reed comes back, we'll have that push up the middle, you know, pushing them right into the arms of Ziggy or Clowney. And Jared Reed hasn't really been a four since he's been back. And maybe it'll take a while for the rust to come off. And maybe you believe he'll regain that form from last year. I don't know. But the other factor was LJ Collier, you know, we're thinking, well, once he starts getting in the mix and getting his feet wet, like that'll be another guy that we can send after people. And he's really not playing that many snaps. Ziggy's been entirely inconsistent, let alone being on the field consistently. And Jared Reed has looked really mortal since he's come back. I don't know where the help is.
Yeah. And the trade deadline just passed and the Seahawks didn't pick anybody up. So they are going to have to get there with what they have. And Pete keeps talking about how he thinks that all these guys just need an opportunity to play together more. Quentin Jefferson's out now, too, due to injury. But I don't know how playing together necessarily translates into a whole lot more pressure when it just seems to me like beating the guy in front of you has a lot more to do with it than knowing who's around you.
Well, I guess the idea being is if you know, in a certain look, the guy next to you is going to maybe stunt one way or hedge towards one gap. You've got a better feel for that. And then maybe you adjust your rush to play off the strengths of what your teammate is doing. And I'm sure there is truth to that. I'm sure there is. But I don't know that there's enough truth to that for me to look at this defense and be like, yeah, they're going to be better come playoff time. So really, I think the only answer is at the end of the day is how do you get better offensively? How do you start, you know, hanging 35 a game rather than close to 30 a game? Because it's what you're going to need to do.
They are going to have to put up a lot of points on the board, and that's what this team is going to have to count on. So will Pete Carroll be able to make that transition from being the defensive-minded coach that he's always been in the past to maybe being a little bit more aggressive when it comes to the game on the offensive side of the ball?
Yeah, and you kind of see that a little bit over the last couple of games with Russ. I mean, they seem to be throwing it just a slightly bit more, but still getting Carson involved. You saw him get Rashad Penny involved in the last game. And I don't know if this is how it felt to you, Brandon, but this is how it felt to me. They got Rashad Penny involved pretty heavily in that game, you know, compared to how he's been playing before, how many snaps.
Sure.
Only to showcase him to other teams around the league. And they were hoping to make a deal at the deadline. And you heard Pete talk about it in a press conference about how it's been real quiet. He's a little sad about it.
Do you think that what were they holding out for, do you think? A first, second, third, and then anything below that they just would have not got? Or do you think that they were desperate to find somebody to take him?
I think it was more like, well, let's hope Penny shows out real good so that a team that could use some extra running back help, or, you know, or really subscribes to that running the football philosophy, is going to want him, say, like, I don't know, the Denver Broncos. And so, like, you look at the Denver Broncos, you go, okay, cool. Like, here's Rashad Penny in a third, and now we can have Von Miller.
Yeah, that would have been okay.
I think that's what they were kind of hoping for, was trying to package Penny, a lower round pick, for a pass rusher. And clearly, around the league, it didn't materialize. Like, the rest of the GMs were like, nope, not helping you guys this year. Sorry.
No. 8 rushes, 55 yards for Rashad Penny. That was a nice showing from him. 20 rushes, 90 yards for Chris Carson. The guy who had the best day on the offense for the Seahawks, to me, had to be Tyler Lockett.
Oh my gosh. I'm really glad that name was the one that you brought up, because I thought you were going to say DK for a second. I was like, cool, he caught a couple wide open touchdown passes. Neat.
But, no, it was this reception too that really sealed it for Tyler Lockett.
Here comes the blitz. Russell has time, throws over the top. One-handed catch. Are you kidding me, Tyler Lockett? How did you make that reception inside the 10? Again, tight coverage, and Lockett finds a way to make the catch for 19 and a first down. Holy catfish. I don't know how he hung on to the ball with one hand.
An incredible catch. He had kind of two of those in the game. The other one wasn't a one-hander where, you know, Russ just dropped it in over the shoulder, and it was, you know, blanket coverage. And yet somehow Tyler comes down with it in a critical situation. We talked about a little bit on previous pods, like who's going to come up with Baldwin's receptions. We're like, obviously it's been Tyler. And he has really been a true number one and has stepped up his game in a huge way. And it's been amazing to watch. I mean, he's phenomenal.
It really has. And yeah, definitely no question about who's taken over for the missing throws that usually went Doug Baldwin's way. I think to a certain extent, you know, there's still some of those third down situations. But in terms of a guy who is covered but is always open, Russell Wilson and Tyler Lockett just seem to have this connection down.
Oh, man, do they ever. And, you know, Russ has been clicking all year and has looked great. And, I mean, that's what we're going to hang our hat on and really hope for, is that Russ can just carry us to, like, the NFC Championship game. And he might be able to do that, especially with the idea that they're hoping Ed Dixon is going to be back here shortly, who is a viable threat as a receiver, as a tight end, which is something we've really sorely been missing since Uncle Will went down. You know, even with Luke Wilson in there, I mean, he's been so-so.
Yeah, and definitely a guy who can hold up in blocking situations, I think, better than anybody else at tight end on the Seahawks roster, too. So he was actually the one who was brought back onto the 53-man roster when Justin Britt was moved to injured reserve.
Right. Oh, and we haven't even gotten to that. We'll touch on that in a second. But addition to Dixon, I think, will be huge, because I know there's a lot of people who are high on Jacob Hollister and think that he could be a real player. I just don't see it. I really don't.
I think we saw why he was moved to the practice squad and none of the other teams in the NFL were really interested.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. He's just another guy, and I'm not going to hang my hat on him. Not that Dixon is a world beater. It's not like I'm looking at him as coming in and being a top five tight end, but just another viable threat to try to, you know, pull coverage a little bit more off of Lockett and off of Metcalf and, you know, see what the offense can do. But, you know, you mentioned Justin Britt, and that is going to be a pretty devastating blow, I think.
I think it's one that they can weather with Joey Hunt, though, because he's a guy who's been with the team all these years. I think he knows the offense well enough that he can be a stopgap at the position. I mean, he is on the smaller end, and I think that he can help the team get by. And I think the obvious guy to fill in is Ethan Posick once he comes back off of IR. But who knows? After Russell Wilson and Joey Hunt have a few games together, Hunt may have the opportunity to solidify his position at that spot.
Well, he might, but I would not put money on it if I was a betting man. Like, I just don't see the pass blocking out of Joey.
Yeah.
He's a fine run blocker, even for being a guy who's undersized. And he is very smart. He knows all the calls and all that stuff, and that's great. But he got dump trucked by a terrible Atlanta defense in pass protection. Like, I don't need to see Russell running for his life with pressure right up the middle. That's a great way to just totally implode an offense.
Yeah, and look at who they have up the middle coming up in this game against Tampa Bay.
Yeah, a familiar face in Sue, so that'll be fun.
Yeah, and Vita Vea, who Husky fans are very familiar with, too.
Right, yeah. That's interesting you bring up the Bucks. I mean, because we're going to have to get into that. I haven't done a lot of research on them. I haven't watched 1 minute of Tampa Bay Buccaneers this season, just because they're a team that just doesn't matter to me. But you talk with our buddy Anthony all the time, the huge Bucks fan, so I'm hoping that you've got some good information and insight on that.
I do, and I do want to get to that because you don't really even need to watch Bucks football, Adam. You can just remember back to Arizona Cardinals football. And the offensively, it's a very similar type of situation, except I think they have better weapons at receiver. But I want to talk about Russell Wilson first and point out the fact that now Russell Wilson has the highest quarterback rating in history, all quarterbacks ever, on the road. Looking at the other names of the top five road quarterbacks with the highest quarterback rating, he's in some pretty solid company here.
Is that for the season or for his career?
Career.
Really? Now, that is a little surprising to me after watching him, especially early in his career, have those road struggles.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know he's had some great road games too, don't get me wrong, but if you would have asked me off the top of my head, much like you did, which linebackers giving up all the yards after the catch, and I got pretty close, I wouldn't have gotten near close with this one. I wouldn't have thought that Russ was in the top 15 all time.
Top five all-time quarterbacks. Number five, the great one, Joe Montana.
Okay.
Number four, the other great one, Tom Brady.
Okay.
Number three, maybe a little surprising, Tony Romo.
Really? I thought you were going to say something like Steve DeBerg or, you know, something really off the wall.
Tony Romo's a big name, but it's just when you think of, when you go from Joe Montana, Tom Brady, to a quarterback who, you know, hasn't won any championships and Tony Romo.
Right.
It's just right. Interesting company. And then, of course, you have the number one rated quarterback in the NFL all time, Aaron Rodgers at number two.
Wow. Okay. That's a pretty esteemed list, you know, even with Romo in there. I mean, it's not like he was
he was no slouch
out there. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Tony Romo could play. He just happened to play for a crappy owner and a crappy organization. I blame most of Tony Romo's failings on, you know, everything else around him.
And Dallas never had a defense when Tony Romo was the quarterback.
True. Well, they did. I mean, it was just, the linebacker that always would get hurt.
Sean Lee.
Yeah. The whole defense was Sean Lee, and that was it. So not his fault.
So I mentioned the Tampa Bay Bucks offense, and it's very similar to the Carson Palmer Arizona Cardinals offense. It's Jameis Winston throwing the ball downfield, looking for those big plays. But it is the receiving crew of this Tampa Bay Bucks team with Mike Evans and Chris Godwin.
Yeah.
Those are two excellent receivers. The biggest deal is when it comes to Jameis Winston, he can't take care of the football. In their five losses with Jameis Winston, 15 turnovers.
Wow.
In their two wins, one turnover.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's very much an idea of, are you going to get, you know, good Winston or bad Winston? I mean, that's what I was thinking going into this discussion about the Bucks. And you said, you know, it's had a hard time protecting the football. Well, that's not just an NFL thing. I mean, he struggled with that in college.
Yes.
And has, you know, ruined a couple coaches' careers. And, you know, Bruce Arians thinks he can come in and, you know, be the genius that resurrects him. But, you know, if I had to choose between Carson Palmer, Jameis Winston, I'm taking Palmer every day of the week. He's a way better trigger man than Jameis Winston has ever dreamed of being. He's going to be out of the league next year. He's going to be the star of the XFL next year.
Well, and it's the turnovers. And in those five losses, as I mentioned, 15 turnovers on the season, he has 12 interceptions and he has 8 fumbles. So some of those fumbles he was able to recover. But I mean, he's almost fumbling the ball as much as he is throwing the ball to the other team.
That's interesting. I didn't realize he was so fumble prone. Unfortunately, our defensive line won't be close enough to him at any given point to make him fumble. So basically, my question would be, you know, having talked to Anthony as much as he had,
yeah,
is Jameis throwing picks when he's under pressure Or is it just Jameis just making bad decisions? Because over the course of his career, what I've watched from him is he'll often just make a terrible decision.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. It's him making terrible decisions. So yeah, five interceptions, no pressure, and seven when he's under pressure. About 50-50.
That's interesting. So basically, because usually what it is with the Seahawks, and I don't know if you agree with this, but it always feels like we'll play that quarterback who's an underachiever. And they always have those like two games a year that they actually play really well.
Yeah.
Like I remember Blake Bortles being awesome against us, like which never happens. And I'm just kind of afraid Jameis is going to come out and have a really good game. And we haven't been good at home this year.
I know. That's the big concern. So are you going to get a Jameis Winston who's going to give up the ball a couple times, or are you not? And I hate going into this game, we're counting on the idea of Jameis Winston giving up two picks to being like a key to victory for the Seahawks. But I kind of feel like it's coming to that.
Yeah, a little bit. The other thing that gives me a little bit of hope, though, is the idea that Griffin, I mean, put him on Evans or Godwin, whoever you think is a better receiver. I know Evans has more of a reputation. I think Godwin's having a better year.
Yeah.
Well, and they don't really travel anyways with the receiver when they go side to side. But, you know, whoever he's on, he's going to shut them down or at least, you know, limit their contribution. It's a matter of Trey Flowers, if he can be back this next week, can he really be, you know, continue on the role that he had been the previous 2 weeks? And if he can do that, then, I mean, that leaves the tight end. Yeah, he's a great tight end.
They haven't been using him. They haven't been using O.J. Howard nearly at all. Cameron Brate, they use kind of inside the red zone. They have 14 touchdowns for the Bucs offense, for the receivers. Six of them to Godwin, six of them to Evans, and two of them to Brate. So those are the only guys that have caught touchdown passes so far among the Bucs receivers.
Okay, interesting, because from the little bit I've paid attention to Buccaneers football this year, like I've been thinking, where's O.J. Howard?
Yeah.
Like, where is this guy? Wasn't he supposed to be great coming out of Alabama? Like, wasn't he going to be a world beater?
Yeah, speaking of Anthony, he's furious that the Bucs didn't trade O.J. Howard for picks because how little they've been using him in the offense.
What does he think he would have gotten for O.J. Howard?
I think he actually thinks that they would have gotten a first-round pick, which I would have been surprised about. But, you know.
They'd have gotten a third.
Or maybe a two for a needy team.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
But still, the idea that they didn't give him up, it's kind of interesting. Just not a whole lot of deals at all right around the trade deadline. Everything happened the week before.
Yeah, really it did. And, you know, the trade market as a whole, like, was pretty active in the offseason. And we had a good trade season. It's just coming up to the deadline, there just really weren't too many deals left to be done.
So one of the things I'm kind of curious about in this game, I feel like it's going to be a very offensive heavy type of game because the Tampa Bay Bucs defense, the Tampa Bay Bucs, Adam, are the number one rush defense in the NFL. And a lot of it has to do with Vita Vea and it has to do with Ndamukong Suh up the middle.
Interesting. I didn't realize they played the run so well so far this year.
They have. And it's something that Anthony backed up too. It's not just some kind of statistical anomaly. The one thing I did notice when watching them though, is it's kind of boom or bust. You know, they're stopping guys for little to no gain or, you know, 1 yard loss, but they are giving up the big runs, especially in that game against Tennessee. They actually had, I think, either 70 or 80 yards rushing. And it felt like all of those yards came on maybe three or four plays.
Right. So my question is too, with their run defense, I mean, has it been a product a little bit of not playing great running teams?
Well, they have played the Rams. They played San Francisco.
The Rams haven't run the ball worth a crap this year. The Niners have.
Yeah. They limited the Carolina Panthers to just 39 yards. So that's impressive.
Yeah. They played them pretty early, though, right?
They did, yeah. But it was right after San Fran. San Fran had almost 100 rushing yards.
Yeah.
Saquon Barkley and the Giants in week 3, 72 yards.
Okay.
They did give up over 100 yards to the New Orleans Saints.
All right.
And then they played the Carolina Panthers again and limited them to 60. So under 100 rushing yards to a Carolina Panthers offense with Christian McCaffrey in two games.
True. And McCaffrey's not, he's not a premier back in the sense of a running back, right? He's more of a do-it-all guy, you know, a combined yards from scrimmage type of guy. So I could see them being able to limit the amount of yards he gets on the ground. But as far as some of the other teams, like, it doesn't surprise me that the Saints ran it well. I mean, Kamara's really great, hell of a player. And, you know, the Niners had some success. So I don't know. I just feel like with our commitment to the run game, that is something that the Seahawks will get done. I mean, they're not going to back away from it if they're not getting it done. I can tell you that.
Yeah, and that's what I'm kind of going into this game with, the expectation that, yeah, the Tampa Bay Bucs do have a number one run defense, but the Seahawks, they're still going to take their chances. And that's what gives me, I think that's what Pete Carroll's going to see, is that they do allow those explosive plays. That's what Pete Carroll likes to get out of his offense. And so he's going to keep plugging away at trying to run the ball. And of course, you have Chris Carson, who can break, you know, umpteen tackles on the way.
Well, again, I mean, the beauty of Chris Carson's game is more the consistency per run, the idea of taking a 1 yard loss and taking it into a 2 or 3 yard gain on the regular.
Yeah.
And then, you know, busting one for 10 yards here or there. And it seems to me that that doesn't speak to exploiting what the Bucs don't do well. To me, I know this is going to sound crazy, but Rashad Penny's style sounds like it actually fits really well with taking advantage of what the Buccaneers do poorly, because he'll be bottled up, and then can rip one off for 45 yards. That's more his game.
Yeah, and I do think running more toward the edges against the Bucs versus trying to run into the heart of the defense is probably more the way to go.
Yeah, especially with your backup center.
Yeah, and I think with the backup center being in there too, I know a lot of fans have kind of been getting on Pete Carroll for going for it on fourth and short situations, and we've seen the Seahawks not have success in a lot of third and short situations too. I went back and I looked at all of the third and three, third and two, third and ones, and fourth and three and shorter, and they are running 53% in those situations. So it's about a coin flip on whether or not they convert those third and short or fourth and short situations so far.
Yeah, I don't know what league average is, but you would hope it'd be at least 50% as far as what the Seahawks are able to accomplish.
Well, I bet good teams are better than 50%.
You would think so.
At least the teams that are more aggressive at going for it in short situations.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, but I don't feel like the Seahawks are terrible in short yardage situations when they actually do run it. I think the big problem with those short yardage plays is they're often doing these little swing passes out of the backfield, or, you know, running Tyler Lockett on a jet sweep motion and then trying to get it into his hands outside, things like that, stuff that these teams are just sitting on.
Yeah. You know, I think that's more been the case in recent games as opposed to the games early on the season. So I didn't see a whole lot of short passes in the first three or four games of the season.
No, not quite to this extent. And, you know, example, in the Falcons game, I can't remember which DK touchdown it was, but first and goal, like, we run it, we get close, and then second goal, and I look at my dad, and I was like, watch, we're going to do some, you know, stupid little pass play here where receiver kind of runs towards a corner and, you know, sort of a fade. And I was like, and it won't work. It's what we do every time. And it just so happens that the Falcons are terrible, so it worked. But I was like, yep, see, there it is. There's that cute, stupid little pass play right there on the goal line. Yeah. Instead of just hammering it down their throat.
Well, when the Falcons decide not to cover Metcalf twice, the first one, Russ caught him off guard. But the second one, you know, that he did, you know, Russell had a guy in his face. And so it was a tough throw to make because he was throwing around a guy right in his face. But, yeah, fortunately, Metcalf opened in the back of the end zone.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying that Russ didn't do a good job there. I hated the play call.
Right.
You know, it's one of those things where you got to be consistent in the way that you want your team to play, you know, especially when you talk like we do to a bunch of people every week. You know, when I say I want them to pound the ball, like, even when it works on those cute little crap, like, I don't want to see that.
Yeah.
I want to see a touchdown Chris Carson. Although this is better for my bet.
Yeah, I think you kind of have your bet locked up at this point, dude.
Don't you dare jinx me like that. Don't you dare. No, I don't have this in the bag. It could all come crashing down tomorrow. Jared Goff could throw for 45 touchdowns over the next three games. It could just happen. You just never know.
Yeah, of course, we are referencing the Bet with the Rams podcast, and it was touchdowns minus interceptions between Russell Wilson and Jared Goff. So Russell Wilson, of course, leading the league in touchdown passes right now, and also leading the league in interception percentage. So just one pick on the year. You're in a good spot, dude.
Efficiency. Yeah, I feel good about that. I also feel good about the idea that after the loss the previous week, they come back, they beat the Falcons, and now all of a sudden Russ is an MVP candidate again, and the Seahawks are a contender again, even though the previous week they weren't.
Yeah, until they lose another game, and then the Seahawks will be done again.
Yeah, they're a contender now after they, you know, basically limped to the finish line against a terrible team in the Falcons.
Now they just have to be perfect.
Yeah, right. But I do expect them to play well down the stretch. And I mean, we talked a little bit after this Tampa game, the schedule gets a little more difficult. It's going to be the meat of it. And it's going to tell us a lot about this team. This Tampa game is kind of your last tune-up going into that stretch.
A little more difficult. It is the most difficult when they do strength of schedule positions, predictions or whatever it's called.
Yeah, calculations or whatever. All I know is I look at the team that they're going to play next and be like, is that a good team or a bad team? And I look down the rest of their schedule now that it's halfway through the season. I've got a feel for who the teams are. I can be like, those teams are better than the teams they played previously.
And the strength of schedule calculations, we make fun of them when it's the first week of the season and they're going off of last year's strength of schedule. This year actually makes sense because these are the same teams that have played together for 8 weeks.
Right. Yeah, it makes a little more sense.
And the reason why the strength of schedule is so hard for the Seahawks, it's because most of their games going down the stretch are against NFC West teams. And two of those games are against the undefeated San Francisco 49ers. Am I allowed to call them undefeated now that it's been now that we're 8 games into the season, 8 weeks into the season?
Yes, certainly. Okay. I'm not gonna poo-poo you on that. I think that's a fair thing to say. Maybe the better way to put it is undefeated for now, since they haven't played us yet.
Right.
I mean, I say that a little cocky, and I'm sure there's a 49ers fan somewhere who listens to this. I don't know why, just because they hate their life, but they're listening, and I'm like, I say that, but really, I'm looking at the Niners right now. I'm going, okay, like, I'm worried.
Yeah, they've got my attention.
Yeah, that front four is legit, and it makes me sick to my stomach to see Sherman playing on another great defense, and it's just not ours.
Right.
Especially in that uniform. Gross.
I know, and then you get to listen to him be all cocky about it, too.
Since I loved it when he was on my team, I can't hate on it when he's on a rival's. I can't.
I can,
but then I'd be even more of a hypocrite than I am.
I think that's part of, I think it goes into being a fanatic.
Well, it does, but we're also, you know, somehow sports analysts in a way. So, you know, better try sure. to check that at the door a little bit. Yeah.
All right, Adam. Well, what do you say we get to the second half of the show and welcome some new members of the flock and get into Do Better and Better at Life?
Oh, yeah. Sounds good.
Getting into the second half of the show, if you're going to be at the game this weekend, you can go to SeahawkersPodcast.com/Bucks. And you can join our Slack channel. Anthony Knockreiner and I will be going out to the game. And so we might have an opportunity to meet up after the game. I think our pregame tailgate spot is going to be closed this week. So that's kind of a bummer. But I have a feeling that we'll be going to Pizza Pros after the game.
There you go. It's a solid plan. I'm sure that you'll find some other way to get a couple beers in you before the game.
Oh, well, no. See, no beer. I've found that out. Any time that I've had beer at a game, it's been a loss. So I have to go hard cider.
Hard cider. But I think you should just do tequila shots. That's what I want
to
see.
Okay. Well, I do have to drive back to Montana after the game. So that could be a difficult ask.
It sounds like a 4-shot drive. It'll be fine.
Oh, well, getting beyond that.
I see that flustered you. You didn't even have a transition.
I have no transition for this.
Yeah, all right. Well, I've got a transition for you. Don't drink and drive. It's a bad idea. It's just a joke. Ha ha. Don't try that at home. You know what else you don't try at home? Nope, I lost it. No, you're right. There's no good transition there.
One thing you can try at home is writing really awesome lyrics for songs for the show. And Keith Kedover, a.k.a. Floctimus Prime, earns an associate producer credit for this incredible song.
It's a podcast called Seahawkers Loves Wilson and Hasselbeck too. It's a show that's crazy about Seahawks, better at life, and do better too. And there's a flock that pays for this content. The show's free, but they do it anyway. You don't have to, but it's value for value. You don't have to, but really you should pay. 'Cause you're free. The pick-ems gotta have prizes, and there's Slack chats during the game. Ring of Honor together on Facebook. So do your part and banish the shame. But you're
thousand awesome things about that. it's pretty hilarious. And okay, number one, like, hats off to Floctimus Prime. Keith got over like with that amazing rendition. One thing that I love, number one, Tom Petty. I love Tom Petty as a kid growing up. Like, that's great stuff. Number two, the term freeloader has become such an integral part of the show. That was never intended to be. It was just an offhanded remark, like one time. It somehow it's become a thing, and we just never know as we do this. That's the kind of the fun part of all of this. And then number three, like, as I sit here, you know, as we're driving across Nebraska, you know, recording this, like, this is why we put in the effort to do it, is for you guys, because you put in this sort of effort for us. It's amazing.
It's so good. And and it is, it's really because people supporting this show that we could do stuff like that.
Yeah.
and especially with Keith coming up with the lyrics on that, he's the one person that I know that consistently puts forth, like, I can go to him and say, hey, what do you think about a song that has to do with this? And he'll come back the next day and he goes, oh, here's the lyrics. And it's good. It's perfect.
And it's beautiful. You remember when David Letterman used to do on his show, like, the stupid human tricks?
Uh-huh.
This is Keith's stupid human trick. He's like unbelievably good at this for like no reason.
I don't know. Maybe he put in a lot of time listening to Weird Al growing up. That could be the reason.
That would definitely help. There's no doubt about it.
And he knows the show perhaps better than anybody else.
Oh yeah, he's definitely a top fiver that way, right? So, like, can you imagine when, like, Keith sends him like the lyrics? He's like, "And do it to Tom Petty, okay?" And the guy starts singing. He's like, "And what in the catfish is this?"
Yeah,
it can't make a lick of sense.
And he did an excellent job with it.
He did. He did. I like that Hasselbeck was mixed in there too. That made me happy.
Well, you just reminded me, Adam. I have a new catfish from the Tyler Lockett catch.
Yards don't matter.
It's not that one.
That wasn't it. That's Yards Don't Matter.
That wasn't it at all. It's this one.
Catfish! I don't like that one as much.
No, I know. I'm so used to the curse one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one. It has more energy to it.
Yeah, it does.
The curse one. Yeah. Yeah, don't mess with success.
Okay, I won't. I'm just, it's now on the board though. I can get rid of it, but I put it there just in case.
Look, what I'm not going to do as your friend is limit your options in the type of catfish you would like to use to dub over my cuss words. Okay. I won't do that to you. You have freedom with that.
Well, some people who are free from the freeloader moniker, Adam.
Yes.
We've got Jesse Amy, who says, so I'm way past the freeloader grace period, 2013, but haven't been in a position to donate until now. So here's the first year of listening at $3 a month. Keep up the great work. Love the show. This is Jesse's in with a $36 one-time donation via PayPal.
Dude, that's awesome. Like, yeah, just the idea that, you know, it does take a few people a little longer to really feel the value of the show. I can understand that. And I'm not even mad at Jesse. In fact, now I'm excited. Thanks for becoming a member of the flock, man.
Some people it's 6 years and some people it's 6 months. Here's an email from Andrew Baldwin. Says, hey guys, been listening for about 6 months and have been shamed enough for my dirty freeloading ways. Love the pod. Keep up the good work. Excited for digs. And more importantly,
catfish,
the Niners.
Yes. All right, yeah. It worked
there. Yes. Maybe that's what it is. It's when telling other teams,
go catfish themselves.
Yeah. To go
catfish
themselves. So maybe it fits it. It's a little tighter than the other one.
Ooh, I think you found the money spot for it.
Andrew goes on to say, yes, I am more worried about them than the Rams now.
Yeah, I agree. We talked about it a little earlier. I'm going to pretend that Andrew Baldwin is actually Doug Baldwin, who's listening to the show, and he just made up a new first name.
Yeah.
To make him sound like a white guy. And and go from there. So I appreciate it, Doug Andrew, for donating to the show, man.
Yeah, in with $20. So
yeah.
Also a welcome to the flock to David Matheson, in for $3. Welcome to the flock to David.
Oh, welcome, David.
Ryan G in at $5 has been listening since the early off season. Love you, crazy
catfishers.
Nothing makes my day at work better than hearing Adam get worked up.
Well, I'm glad to help at your day at work. I hope you don't get too worked up yourself and, like, you know, take it out on a coworker. Like, I hope it's cathartic, maybe. Like, you're mad at a different coworker, then you hear me rant about something, and then it all gets let go. That's what I'm hoping for.
Another welcome to the flock to Banked Asplund, says, original Hawks fan now living in New York City. I just started listening to the show after having listened to Field Goals for a long time. You're both great. Plus, Emmert accent sounds just like my good buddy Blair from back home in Seattle, and it makes the whole podcast that much funnier. Keep up the good work.
Dude, all I know is that Blair must be awesome and also sound like Bill Burr on occasion.
And we got another Largent in. Cody Largent is in at $3, Adam.
Dude, we're collecting all the Largents.
Yes, Andy's brother Cody. He
heard the call.
He heard the call, says, hey guys, I just want to thank you for calling me out for my wicked and evil ways. I pledge going forward, I will not poach free content. While it's true I reside in Bronco country, boo, I still have green and blue blood running through my veins. I also want to point out to my brother Andy that I have been a Seahawk fan longer than him. I'm 9 years older. And he will never be able to top my fandom. I'm sure on Sundays he can hear my screams all the way in Seattle. By the way, love the show, especially now that I don't have to hang my head in shame. And I can once again walk down the streets of Denver with my head held high, sporting my Largent jersey. Great job on the show, and go Hawks.
Oh, it should be real easy these days with the Broncos sucking as bad as they do. But, I'm glad that Cody has made the effort. Now, calling his ways wicked and evil to this point, I mean, that's a little strong. I don't think we, like, really, like, called him a Salem witch or anything. But, you know, just a little bit of a freeloader.
We just had a song made to help call him out. But he came in with a donation before we could.
Yeah.
Don't be free.
Now he's not freeloading.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was quite the haul this week. Lots of new little flockers.
Oh, I still got three more, Adam. We got Paul. What? We got Paul Russell in at $5. So, see, another Russell. We're collecting last names of great Seahawks players.
That's exactly right. That's incredible. Okay.
Of course, you know, Russell Wilson, first name, but I can't think of a last name with Russell. of a legendary Seahawk.
Well, Russell Okung, there's another first name.
Another first name. Not quite legendary, but...
No, but, you know, Super Bowl champion.
Paul Vogelsberger gave us a raise from 5 to 12-12.
Oh, wow. Well, welcome to the Ring of Honor, Paul.
I know. I haven't seen him on Facebook yet, but if Paul is not getting in for some reason and wants to, let us know.
Yeah. Well, you should want to, because it's like the coolest place on the internet.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Quentin Ramirez in at $3.
That's really close to Quadre. So, like, maybe Quadre will be the next great one. Quadre Diggs.
Yeah.
Anybody that has a name that starts with Q has immediate respect for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a killer letter. It might be the best letter.
And, you know, kind of a, you know, coming from an Adam and a Brandon, not a lot of Q names out there.
No. I guess maybe that's what it is with my, you know, boring first biblical name ever. Like, I appreciate, you know, people that have creativity, you know, say like with a Q in it or an apostrophe, you know, stuff like that.
So welcome to the flock to Quentin Ramirez in at $3.
Yeah, he's Quandre Ramirez from now on.
All right, well, moving on. I got a question here on Twitter, Adam. I wanted to throw this out to you.
Okay.
This coming in from after the Baltimore game says, took most of the week to mourn the loss. Wasn't ready to talk Seahawks football until today. Thanks to you guys for helping me cope, move on, and feel better. Question, and I may be speaking blasphemy, but do you think Carroll is losing some of his nerve and or mojo? Still has the energy, can develop players and motivate, but seems like he's getting outcoached a lot this season in terms of game plans, and his third and fourth and short decisions are way out of whack.
That's actually a good question. As far as the third and fourth down decisions,
this is the tweet that prompted me to go back and look at those third and fourth and short. And when it's a coin flip decision, I'm not sure if I can be that critical, because then it's at that point to where it becomes more of a feel than an easy decision, if that makes any sense, because you have to take into account not just whether or not that it makes sense statistically to go for it. You have to take into account the defense that you're going up against, the offense that you have, the situation that you're in terms of score. You have to take into account, you know, whether or not you have the plays that you want to call against that defense in those short yardage situations. So I think that it's been made to be so much more of a statistical argument of when to go for it on these third and fourth and short situations, that we're losing a lot of those other things that go into it when you are a 50-50 type team.
Yeah, there is a degree of that, right? Like, I think the stat nerds have really kind of glomped onto the always go for it on fourth down thing. I mean, there was that high school coach that never punts, you know, all that stuff. And sure, I get that to a degree. But yeah, situationally, that is kind of the... I think that's the thing that you think about the most, just all those different situations that you brought up, and Belichick being the best at situational football. I think a little bit of it is, number one, I don't think Carroll's deviated a lot from what he's done in the past in those situations, except for you've heard him talk about when he's been panned for being too aggressive of, oh, I got a little emotional.
Yeah,
and, you know, got a little hormonal, I think is what he said a couple times, right? Uh-huh. And I think he's mellowed out a little bit more in his, you know, young old age, and is trying to be a little more level-headed about things. And I think in that, he's probably not going forward as much as, say, I would like. But I don't know that he's getting out-coached on the regular in the sense that he's doing a ton differently now than what he was doing before, you know, when the team was at the peak of its powers. The difference is the talent of the players around him. He's always run a relatively simplistic system, especially on defense, and relied on the fact that we're just better than you.
Right.
And doesn't quite have all the pieces for that. And I think it shows. And as I say all of that, we sit here at 6-2. You know, went to the playoffs last year when everybody left us for dead, and we're right in the thick of everything. And I'm sitting here whining and saying that he's might have lost a step. But yeah, it's just a matter of personnel more so than his coaching ability. Then at this point, I don't know that he's ever been the greatest X's and O's coach. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Well, you know, he does so many other things well that other coaches don't do, right? Like build culture. Like go and find another team. We just saw, you know, Michael Bennett get traded to the Cowboys because he was with the Patriots. And the New England Patriots definitely have a culture, but it's not something that a lot of players can fit into. Whereas right. I think with the Seahawks, it's player friendly to the point that just about anybody can fit in as long as you follow those mantras, like Pete says, of protecting the team. And you want to protect the team when you're brought into the type of situation, because you feel like everybody has your back and you feel cared for and that the team wants to see you succeed. So you hear from players that have gone other places and come back, and they talk about just how rare it is to find that type of culture in so many other places. So when you can build something like that, it's part of the reason why the Seahawks have consistently been a playoff team.
I couldn't agree with you more. When you look at the teams across the NFL over the past 10 years that have had the most consistent culture, it's easily the Patriots and the Seahawks. And, you know, you talk about that's one of his strengths, and I think he is the best at it in the league.
Yeah.
I think he's even better at that than Belichick is, and not just by being more inclusive per se, but one of the things I've always admired about Pete is he's talked about when he got fired from the Patriots and went to USC, he sat down and really focused and came up with a firm definition of his coaching philosophy, the things that mattered the most to him and how he was going to get them done. And he sticks to that. And part of that is the positivity and always competing. And you combine those two things and it creates a locker room that is so much more cohesive, and you win a bunch of those close games because you're playing for your brother and you're playing for your coach in a way that a lot of other teams aren't.
Yeah. And it's such a positive mentality that even when you're down by multiple scores, you don't feel like you're out of the game. With the way Pete Carroll coaches the team, the Seahawks don't win that 2014 NFC Championship game against the Packers.
That is absolutely correct. Yeah. That's a great example right there. And just really any time that they get down, I mean, you can count on one hand how many times they've gotten blown out in the Pete Carroll era.
Right.
It's incredible. And that is a testament to the culture and the mindset that he brings, the way he cares about players, the way that they focus on mental health and in their health and their relationships outside of football, all of that stuff. And it makes a huge difference. And that does help make up for the fact that he's not the greatest X's and O's coach. You know, I mean, he's a very good one. I'm not trying to say that he's a bad one.
Right.
I'm just saying there's other guys out there that are smarter schematically.
Sure, like Bill Belichick, Sean Payton.
Sure, yeah, exactly. And that's fine. But are they as good at building culture? I don't think so.
No. So a big thanks to Jeff Scott at JeffScottAZ12 for that question on Twitter. What do you say we get into some do better and better at life?
Yeah, let's do that, because I hadn't thought about this at all.
Well, you can just piggyback on mine. I've got you covered, dude.
Okay, good.
Unless something comes to mind while you're doing this, but.
Well, all right. Well, I'll just do one off the cuff here. Nebraska is flat. There's nothing here. This thing is flatter than my ex-girlfriend. Like, I hate Nebraska. I'm not into it at all. Get a mountain. Do better.
Plate tectonics in the center of the U.S. Do better.
Yeah. That made my girlfriend laugh as she's driving down the road there. That one, the current one.
Yeah. My do better is for Montana. While we're calling out states, I'm going to call out my home state, Adam.
Easy.
normally people in Montana are pretty cool, except when it comes to buying Halloween candy.
Yeah.
Candystore.com, which is a bulk distributor, it took a look at 12 years of its sales data, and it came up with a map of the most bought candy in each state.
Okay.
And, you know, like any good clickbait headline, the results of this data, Adam, will shock you.
Oh, I'm sure it will. But shock has to be in capital letters.
Yes. Okay. The top most popular Halloween candy in Montana is Double Bubble.
I don't buy that for a second.
Double Bubble. The crappy gum.
Sure?
That comes in a single wrap package that has about 2 seconds of flavor is Montana's favorite Halloween candy.
Well, isn't that Pete Carroll's favorite gum?
No,
that's what he chews?
That's Hubba Bubba.
Forgive me for confusing Hubba Bubba and Double Bubble. They sound nothing alike.
Yeah, but Hubba Bubba has like 20 times more of flavor time than Double Bubble does.
And sex appeal. I mean, Hubba Bubba. Yeah.
And plus, Double Bubble is that gum that you chew for like 5 seconds and it starts to get so hard that it makes your jaw sore.
Well, maybe you're looking at this all wrong. Maybe you buy all that Double Bubble so you can chew it so it can turn into concrete and then you can make a foundation to build your log cabin on. Maybe that's
being used so much. Is that what you use to build your cabin?
My next cabin is going to be made of that, I'm pretty sure, is a foundation of rock hard Double Bubble, and it will be impervious to both earthquake and forest fire. Double Bubble doesn't burn.
No. I didn't see that in the Q&A section. I went on to Amazon to see what the reviews out there were for the gum.
Yeah.
And the number one question was, does this gum lose its flavor? Yes, of course this gum loses its flavor. It loses it in about 2 seconds, which is the all-time record of all gums out there. And for Montana, for having this gum as its number one Halloween candy, do better.
I've never even seen Double Bubble in Montana.
It comes in those mixed bags, usually.
Yeah, in the mixed bags, but I've never seen like a sack of Double Bubble. So I'm having a hard time buying this from, HalloweenCandyIsUs.com /bogus study.
Nebraska and Wyoming, the two states that you're traveling across. Oh, and also Washington, is their favorite is taffy, the single wrap taffy.
Oh, is it Laffy Taffy, like with jokes, or just regular taffy?
No, just the taffy balls.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, if you really do want great taffy, though, a quick shout out to the Sweet Palace in Phillipsburg, Montana. You can order it online. They do it all in-house. Like, they pull their own taffy, and there's probably like 150 flavors, and it's amazing. So just order yourself up some of that instead for Halloween.
Yeah, it would be 100 times better than Double Bubble.
Yeah. 100 times better. All right, man. I came up with a better at life on the fly.
Sweet. Is it for Nebraska?
No, most certainly not for Nebraska still. Yeah. Still flat. No, my better at life than Skip Bayless this week is for LeBron James, because he has a mansion in one of the areas that one of the numerous California wildfires is going on in. And basically, he got evacuated. He was driving around trying to figure out what to do. See what he did the next day? He went and he solicited a taco truck on Taco Tuesday, because he's a big fan of the Taco Tuesday. Yeah. Brought the taco truck down and fed all the firefighters.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So LeBron James better at life than Skip Bayless. You keep the firefighters happy. It keeps your mansion from burning down.
I heard that he had a hard time finding a place to stay after he was evacuated.
Yeah, that didn't ring true to me. Like, I don't feel like that'd been a real difficult thing. I have a feeling like, well, number one, he's got a fair amount of teammates he could ring up and be like, hey, homie, like, I need to, bring the fam over and sleep in the basement.
Right.
Number two, can he rent just like an entire hotel? And number three, doesn't he have other homes?
Number four, just post on Twitter. Hey, does anybody have a place for me to crash tonight?
Yep, I'm sure he would have one. No doubt.
I think he'd do all right.
Yeah.
But keeping the firefighters happy for sure. Good for him. And that leads me to my better at life this week is for the linebacker tandem of Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright. And because we got to go back and mention the fact that Bobby Wagner, he now tops the list of Seahawks all-time leading tacklers.
Sure does.
Passed Eugene Robinson in the game against the Falcons. KJ Wright, he recently passed Joe Nash, who played with the Seahawks longer than any other player. I think 15 seasons, something like 218 games, crazy numbers. And now KJ just needs 30 tackles to move ahead of Keith Butler, and he'll be number three on the list.
That's amazing. Yeah,
I know. So for the greatest linebacker tandem that played together all in their prime since 2014, they've combined for more tackles, 1,278, than any other linebacker tandem in the league over that time period. Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright, better at life than Skip Bayless.
What a great way to wrap up the show, recognizing those two guys. What a treasure it's been to have those two on this particular iteration of the Seahawks. Just a pleasure to watch, and very deserving guys.
And with Adam cutting out and potentially going out of cell phone range.
Yeah, with that, there's only one thing left to say.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks. Plays going down the field. So they have to.
Oh, I lost you.
All right. I went by a semi.
No. So they have to, is where you said. Nope.
So the theory being, okay, you got me now?
Yeah, I got you now.
Okay. So the theory is they dropped him.
No, I don't have you. Damn it. Do I have you now?
I don't know. Do you have me now?
I do have you now.
All right, I'm down to one bar. We'll see.